guards temporarily reassigned. Percy had gone on to Briar Ridge. "Come here," Brutal said in a funny, squeezed voice that made me look around at him sharply. I had just come in out of a cold and sleety night and had been brushing off the shoulders of my coat prior to hanging it up. "Was something wrong?" I asked. "No," he said, "but I found out where Mr. Jingles was getting in and out. When he first came, I mean, before Delacroix took him over. Do you want to see?" Of course I did. I followed him down the green mile to the restraint room. All the stuff we kept stored in there was out in the hall. Brutal had apparently taken advantage of the lull in customer traffic to do some cleaning up. The door was open, and I saw our mop bucket inside. The floor, that same sick lime shade as the green mile itself, was drying in streaks. Standing in the middle of the floor was a stepladder, the one that was usually kept in the storage room, which also happened to serve as the final stop for the state's condemned. There was a shelf jutting out from the back of the ladder near the top, the sort of thing a workman would use to hold his toolkit or a painter the bucket he was working out of. There was a flashlight on it. Brutal handed it to me. "Get on up there. You're shorter than me, so you'll have to go pretty near all the way, but I'll hold your legs." "I'm ticklish down there," I said, starting up, "especially my knees." "I'll mind that." "Good," I said. "Because a broken hip's too high a price to pay in order to discover the origins of a single mouse." "Huh?" "Never mind." My head was up by the caged light in the center of the ceiling by then, and I could feel the ladder wiggling a little under my weight. Outside, I could hear the winter wind moaning. "Just hold on to me. I got you, don't worry." He gripped my calves firmly, and I went up one more step. Now the top of my head was less than a foot from the ceiling, and I could see the cobwebs a few enterprising spiders had spun and the crotches where the roof beams came together. I shone the light around, but didn't see anything worth the risk of being up here. "No," Brutal said, "you're looking too far away, boss. Look to your left where those two beams come together. You see them? One's a little discolored."
"I see."
"Shine the light on the join." I did, and saw what he wanted me to see almost right away. The beams had been pegged together with dowels, half a dozen of them, and one was gone, leaving a black circular hole the size of a quarter. I looked at it, then looked doubtfully back over my shoulder at Brutal. "It was a small mouse," I said, "but that small, man, I don't think so." "But that's where he went," Brutal said. "I'm just as sure as houses."
"I don't see how you can be."
"Lean closer, don't worry, I got you, and take a whiff." I did as he asked, groping with my left hand for one of the other beams and feeling a little better when I had hold of it. The wind outside gusted again. Air puffed out of that hole and into my face. I could smell the keen breath of a winter night in the border south, and something else as well. The smell of peppermint.
"Don't let nothing happen to Mr. Jingles,"
I could hear Delacroix saying in a voice that wouldn't stay steady. I could hear that, and I could feel the warmth of Mr. Jingles as the Frenchman handed it to me. "Just a mouse. Smarter than most of the species, no doubt, but still just a mouse for a that and a that. Except this one had no business being alive at all."
"Don't let that baden hurt my mouse," he'd said.
And I had promised, as I always promised them at the end, when walking the Green Mile was no longer a myth or a hypothesis, but something they really had to do. "Mail this letter to my brother who I haven't seen for 20 years, I promise. Say 15 Hail Marys for my soul, I promise. Let me die under my spirit name and see that it goes on my tombstone, I promise." It was the way you got them to go and be good about it, the way you saw them into the chair sitting at the end of the Green Mile with their sanity intact. I couldn't keep all of those promises, of course. But I kept the one I made to Delacroix. As for the Frenchman himself, there had been hell to pay. The Baden hadn't been allowed to hurt the mouse, not a second time, but he had hurt Delacroix, hurt him plenty. Oh, I know what he did, all right, but no one deserved what happened to Edouard Delacroix when he fell into old Sparky's savage embrace. A smell of peppermint. And something else. Something back inside that hole. I took a pen out of my breast pocket with my right hand, still holding onto the beam with my left, not worried anymore about Brutal inadvertently tickling my sensitive knees. I unscrewed the pen's cap one-handed, then poked the nib in and teased something out. It was a tiny splinter of wood, which had been tinted a bright yellow. And I heard Delacroix's voice again, so clearly this time that his ghost might have been lurking in that room with us, the one where William Wharton spent so much of his time. "Hey, you guys," the voice said this time, the laughing, amazed voice of a man who has forgotten, at least for a little while, where he is and what awaits him. "Come and see what Mr. Jingles can do."
"Christ," I whispered. I felt as if the wind had been knocked out of me.
"You found another one, didn't you?" Brutal asked. "I found three or four." I came down and shone the light on his big outstretched palm. Several splinters of wood were scattered there, like jackstraws for elves. Two were yellow, like the one I had found. One was green and one was red. They hadn't been painted, but colored with wax Crayola crayons. "Oh, boy," I said in a low, shaky voice. "Oh, hey, it's pieces of that spool, isn't it? But why? Why up there?" "When I was a kid, I wasn't big like I am now," Brutal said. "I got most of my growth between 15 and 17. Until then, I was a shrimp. And when I went off to school the first time, I felt as small as... why, as small as a mouse, I guess you'd say. I was scared to death. So you know what I did?" I shook my head. Outside, the wind gusted again. In the angles formed by the beams, cobwebs shook in feathery drafts like rotted lace. Never had I been in a place that felt so nakedly haunted. And it was right then, as we stood there, looking down at the splintered remains of the spool which had caused so much trouble, that my head began to know what my heart had understood ever since John Coffey had walked the Green Mile. I couldn't do this job much longer. Depression or no depression, I couldn't watch many more men walk through my office to their deaths. Even one more might be too many. "I asked my mother for one of her hankies," Brutal said. "So when I felt weepy and small, I could sneak it out and smell her perfume and not feel so bad." "You think... what? That mouse chewed off some of that colored spool to remember Delacroix by? That a mouse?" He looked up. I thought for a moment I saw tears in his eyes, but I guess I was probably wrong about that. "I ain't saying nothing, Ball, but I found them up there, and I smelled peppermint same as you. You know you did. And I can't do this no more. I won't do this no more. Seeing one more man in that chair just about kill me. I'm going to put in for a transfer to Boys Correctional on Monday. If I get it before the next one, that's fine. If I don't, I'll resign and go back to farming." "What did you ever farm besides rocks? It don't matter." "I know it doesn't," I said. "I think I'll put in with you." He looked at me close, making sure I wasn't just having some sport with him, then nodded as if it was a settled thing. The wind gusted again, strong enough this time to make the beams creak, and and settle. And we both looked around uneasily at the padded walls. I think for a moment we could hear William Wharton, not Billy the Kid, not him, he had been Wild Bill to us from his first day on the block, screaming and laughing, telling us we were going to be damned glad to be rid of him, telling us we would never forget him. About those things he was right. As for what Brutal and I agreed on that night in the restraint room, it turned out just that way. It was almost as if we had taken a solemn oath on those tiny bits of colored wood. Neither of us ever took part in another execution. John Coffey was the last.
Part 2. The Mouse on the Mile.
Chapter 1. The nursing home, where I am crossing my last bunch of T's and dotting my last mess of I's, is called Georgia Pines. It's about 60 miles from Atlanta and about 200 light-years from life as most people under the age of 80, let's say, live it. You who are reading this want to be careful that there isn't a place like it waiting in your future. It's not a cruel place, not for the most part. There's cable TV, the food's good, although there's damn little a man can chew. But in its way, it's as much of a killing bottle as E Block at Cold Mountain ever was. There's even a fella here who reminds me a little of Percy Wetmore, who got his job on the Green Mile because he was related to the governor of the state. I doubt if this fella's related to anyone important, even though he acts that way. Brad Dolan, his name is. He's always combing his hair like Percy was, and he's always got something to read stuffed into his back pocket. With Percy, it was magazines like Argosy and Men's Adventure. With Brad, it's these little paperbacks called Gross Jokes and Sick Jokes. He's always asking people why the Frenchmen cross the road, or how many Pollocks it takes to screw in a light bulb, or how many pallbearers there are at a Harlem funeral. Like Percy, Brad is a dimwit who thinks nothing is funny unless it's mean. Something Brad said the other day struck me as actually smart, but I don't give him a lot of credit for it. Even a stopped clock is right twice a day, the proverb has it. "You're just lucky you don't have that Alzheimer's disease, Polly," was what he said. I hate him calling me that, Polly, but he goes on doing it anyway. I've given up asking him to quit. There are other sayings, not quite proverbs, that apply to Brad Dolan. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, is one. You can dress him up, but you can't take him out, is another. In his thick-headedness, he is also like Percy. When he made his comment about Alzheimer's, he was mopping the floor of the solarium, where I'd been going over the pages I've already written. There's a great lot of them, and I think there's apt to be a great lot more before I'm through. "That Alzheimer's, do you know what it really is?" "No," I said, "but I'm sure you'll tell me, Brad." "It's AIDS for old people," he said, and then burst out laughing, hook-a-hook-a-hook-a-hook, just like he does over those idiotic jokes of his. I didn't laugh, though, because what he said struck a nerve somewhere. Not that I have Alzheimer's, although there's plenty of it on view here at beautiful Georgia Pines. I myself just suffer the standard old guy memory problems. Those problems seem to have more to do with when than what. Looking over what I've written so far, it occurs to me that I remember everything that happened back in 32. It's the order of events that sometimes gets confused in my head. Yet, if I'm careful, I think I can keep even that sorted out. More or less. John Coffey came to E Block and the Green Mile in October of that year, condemned for the murder of the 9-year-old Detterick twins. That's my major landmark, and if I keep it in view, I should do just fine. William Wild Bill Wharton came after Coffey, Delacroix came before. So did the Mouse. The one Brutus Howell, Brutal, to his friends, called Steamboat Willie, and Delacroix ended up calling Mr. Jingles. Whatever you called him, The mouse came first, even before Dell. It was still summer when he showed up, and we had two other prisoners on the Green Mile, the chief, Arlen Bitterbuck, and the Prez, Arthur Flanders. That mouse. That goddamn mouse. Delacroix loved it, but Percy Wetmore sure didn't. Percy hated it from the first. Chapter 2. The mouse came back just about 3 days after Percy had chased it down the Green Mile that first time. Dean Stanton and Bill Dodge were talking politics, which meant in those days they were talking Roosevelt and Hoover, Herbert, not J. Edgar. They were eating Ritz crackers from a box Dean had purchased from old Toot Toot an hour or so before. Percy was standing in the office doorway, practicing quick draws with the baton he loved so much as he listened. He'd pull it out of that ridiculous hand-tooled holster he'd gotten somewhere, then twirl it, or try to. Most times he would have dropped it, if not for the rawhide loop he kept on his wrist. Then reholster it. I was off that night, but got the full report from Dean the following evening. The mouse came up the Green Mile just as it had before, hopping along, then stopping and seeming to check the empty cells. After a bit of that, it would hop on, undiscouraged, as if it had known all along it would be a long search, and it was up to that. The president was awake this time, standing at his cell door. That guy was a piece of work, managing to look natty even in his prison blues. We knew just by the way he looked that he wasn't made for old Sparky, and we were right. Less than a week after Percy's second run at that mouse, the Prez's sentence was commuted to life, and he joined the general population. "Say," he called, "there's a mouse in here. What kind of a joint are you guys running, anyway?" He was kind of laughing, but Dean said he also sounded kind of outraged, as if even a murder rap hadn't been quite enough to knock the Kiwanis out of his soul. He had been the regional head of an outfit called Mid-South Realty Associates, and had thought himself smart enough to be able to get away with pushing his half-senile father out a third-story window and collect on a double indemnity whole life policy. On that he had been wrong, but maybe not by much. "Shut up, you lagoon," Percy said, but that was pretty much automatic. He had his eye on the mouse. He had reholstered his baton and taken out one of his magazines, but now he tossed the magazine on the duty desk and pulled the baton out of its holster again. He began tapping it casually against the knuckles of his left hand. "Son of a bitch," Bill Dodge said. "I never seen a mouse in here before." "Ah, he's sort of cute," Dean said, "and not afraid at all." "How do you know?" "He was in the other night. Percy saw him, too. Brutal calls him Steamboat Willie." Percy kind of sneered at that, but for the time being said nothing. He was tapping the baton on the back of his hand faster now. "Watch this," Dean said. "He came all the way up to the desk before. I want to see if he'll do it again." It did, skirting wide of the Prez on its way, as if it didn't like the way our resident parasite smelled. It checked two of the empty cells, even ran up onto one of the bare, unmattressed cots for a sniff, then came back to the Green Mile. And Percy, standing there the whole time, tapping and tapping, not talking for a change, wanting to make it sorry for coming back, wanting to teach it a lesson.
"Good thing you guys don't have to put him in Sparky," Bill said, interested in spite of himself. "You'd have a hell of a time getting the clamps and the cap on."
Percy said nothing still, but he very slowly gripped the baton between his fingers, the way a man would hold a good cigar. The mouse stopped where it had before, no more than 3 feet from the duty desk, looking up at Dean like a prisoner before the bar. It glanced up at Bill for a moment, then switched its attention back to Dean. Percy, it hardly seemed to notice at all.
"Well, he's a brave little bastard, I gotta give him that," Bill said.
He raised his voice a little.
"Hey! Hey! Steamboat Willie!"
The mouse flinched a little and fluttered its ears, but it didn't run or even show any signs of wanting to.
"Now watch this," Dean said, remembering how Brutal had fed it some of his corned beef sandwich. "I don't know if he'll do it again, but..."
He broke off a piece of Ritz cracker and dropped it in front of the mouse.
It just looked, with its sharp black eyes, at the orangey fragment for a second or two, its filament-fine whiskers twitching as it sniffed. Then it reached out, picked a cracker up in its paws, sat up, and began to eat.
"Well, I'll be shucked and boiled," Bill exclaimed. "Eats as neat as a parson on Parish House Saturday night."
"Looks more like a nigger eating watermelon to me," Percy remarked, but neither guard paid him any mind. Neither did the chief or the prez, for that matter.
The mouse finished the cracker, but continued to sit, seemingly balanced on the talented coil of its tail, looking up at the giants in blue.
"Let me try," Bill said.
He broke off another piece of cracker, leaned over the front of the desk, and dropped it carefully. The mouse sniffed, but did not touch.
"Huh," Bill said, "must be full."
"Nah," Dean said. "He knows you're a floater, that's all."
"Floater, am I? I like that. I'm here almost as much as Harry Terwilliger, maybe more."
"Simmer down, old-timer, simmer down," Dean said, grinning. "But watch and see if I'm not right."
He bombed another piece of cracker over the side. Sure enough, the mouse picked that one up and began to eat again, still ignoring Bill Dodge's contribution completely. But before it had done more than take a preliminary nibble or two, Percy threw his baton at it, launching it like a spear. The mouse was a small target, and give the devil his due, it was a wickedly good shot and might have taken Willie's head clean off if its reflexes hadn't been as sharp as shards of broken glass. It ducked, yes, just as a human being would have, and dropped the chunk of cracker. The heavy hickory baton passed over its head and spine, close enough so its fur ruffled. That's what Dean said, anyway, and so I pass it on, although I'm not sure I really believe it. Then hit the green linoleum and bounced against the bars of an empty cell. The mouse didn't wait to see if it was a mistake. Apparently remembering a pressing engagement elsewhere, it turned and was off down the corridor toward the restraint room in a flash. Percy roared with frustration. He knew how close he had come, and chased after it again. Bill Dodge grabbed at his arm, probably out of simple instinct, but Percy pulled away from him. Still, Dean said, it was probably that grab which saved Steamboat Willie's life, and it was still a near thing. Percy wanted not just to kill the mouse, but squash it, so he ran in big, comical leaps like a deer, stamping down with his heavy black work shoes. The mouse barely avoided Percy's last two jumps, first zigging and then zagging. It went under the door with a final flick of its long pink tail, and so long, stranger, it was gone.
"Fuck!"
Percy said, and slammed the flat of his hand against the door. Then he began to sort through his keys, meaning to go into the restraint room and continue the chase. Dean came down the corridor after him, deliberately walking slow in order to get his emotions under control. Part of him wanted to laugh at Percy, he told me, but part of him wanted to grab the man, whirl him around, pin him against the restraint room door, and wail the living shit out of him. Most of it, of course, was just being startled. Our job on E-Block was to keep Rumpus to a minimum, and Rumpus was practically Percy Wetmore's middle name. Working with him was sort of like trying to defuse a bomb with somebody standing behind you and every now and then clashing a pair of cymbals together. In a word, upsetting. Dean said he could see that upset in Arlen Bitterbuck's eyes, even in the president's eyes, although that gentleman was usually as cool as the storied cucumber. And there was something else as well. In some part of his mind, Dean had already begun to accept the mouse as, well, maybe not as a friend, but as part of life on the block. That made what Percy had done and what he was trying to do not right. Not even if it was a mouse he was trying to do it to. And the fact that Percy would never understand why it wasn't right was pretty much the perfect example of why he was all wrong for the job he thought he was doing. By the time Dean got to the end of the corridor, he had gotten himself under control again and knew how he wanted to handle the matter. The one thing Percy absolutely couldn't stand was to look foolish, and we all knew it. "Cases foiled again," he said, grinning a little, kidding Percy along. Percy gave him an ugly look and flicked his hair off his brow.
"Watch your mouth, Four Eyes. I'm riled. Don't make it worse."
So it's moving day again, is it?
Dean said, not quite laughing, but laughing with his eyes.
Well, when you get everything out this time, would you mind mopping the floor?
Percy looked at the door, looked at his keys, thought about another long, hot, fruitless rummage in the room with the soft walls while they all stood around and watched him, the chief and the prez, too.
I'll be goddamned if I understand what's so funny, he said. We don't need mice in a cell block. We got enough vermin in here already without adding mice.
Whatever you say, Percy, Dean said, holding up his hands.
He had a moment right there, he told me the next night, when he believed Percy might just take after him. Bill Dodge strolled up then and smoothed it over.
Think you dropped this, he said, and handed Percy his baton. An inch lower, you would have broken the little bastard's back.
Percy's chest expanded at that.
Yeah, it wasn't a bad shot,
he said, carefully reseating his head knocker in its foolish holster.
I used to be a pitcher in high school. Threw two no-hitters.
Is that right now?
Bill said, and the respectful tone of voice, although he winked at Dean when Percy turned away, was enough to finish defusing the situation.
Yeah, Percy said. Threw one down in Knoxville, those city boys didn't know what hit him. Walked two. Could have had perfect game if the ump hadn't been such a lagoon.
Dean could have left it at that, but he had seniority on Percy, and part of a senior's job is to instruct. And at that time, before coffee, before Delacroix, he still thought Percy might be teachable. So he reached out and grasped Percy's wrist.
You want to think about what you was doing just now, Dean said.
His intention, he said later, was to sound serious but not disapproving. Not too disapproving anyway. Except with Percy, that didn't work. He might not learn, but we would eventually.
Say, Four Eyes, I know what I was doing, trying to get that mouse. What are you, blind?
You also scared the cheese out of Bill, out of me, and out of them,
Dean said, pointing in the direction of Bitterbuck and Flanders.
So what?
Percy asked, drawing himself up.
They ain't in cradle school, in case you didn't notice, although you guys treat them that way half the time.
Well, I don't like to be scared, Bill rumbled, and I work here, Wetmore, in case you didn't notice. I ain't one of your lagoons.
Percy gave him a look that was narrow-eyed and a touch uncertain.
And we don't scare them any more than we have to, because they're under a lot of strain, Dean said.
He was still keeping his voice low.
Men that are under a lot of strain can snap, hurt themselves, hurt others, sometimes get folks like us in trouble, too.
Percy's mouth twitched at that. In trouble was an idea that had power over him. Making trouble was okay, getting into it was not.
Our job is talking, not yelling, Dean said. A man who's yelling at prisoners is a man who has lost control.
Percy knew who had written that scripture. Me, the boss. There was no love lost between Percy Wetmore and Paul Edgecombe, and this was still summer, remember, long before the real festivities started.
You'll do better, Dean said, if you think of this place as like an intensive care ward in a hospital.
It's best to be quiet. I think of it as a bucket of piss to drown rats in, Percy said, and that's all. Now let me go.
He tore free of Dean's hand, stepped between him and Bill, and stalked up the corridor with his head down. He walked a little too close to the president's side, close enough so that Flanders could have reached out, grabbed him, and maybe head-whipped him with his own prized hickory baton, had Flanders been that sort of man. He wasn't, of course, but the chief perhaps was. The chief, if given a chance, might have administered such a beating just to teach Percy a lesson. What Dean said to me on that subject when he told me this story the following night has stuck with me ever since, because it turned out to be a kind of prophecy.
Wetmore don't understand that he hasn't got any power over them, Dean said. That nothing he does can really make things worse for them, that they can only be electrocuted once. Until he gets his head around that, he's going to be a danger to himself and everyone else down here.
Percy went into my office and slammed the door behind him.
My, my, Bill Dodge said. Ain't he the swollen and badly infected testicle?
You don't know the half of it, Dean said.
Oh, look on the bright side, Bill said. He was always telling people to look on the bright side. It got so you wanted to punch his nose every time it came out of his mouth. Your trick mouse got away, at least.
Yeah, but we won't see him no more, Dean said. I imagine this time goddamn Percy Wetmore scared him off for good.
Chapter 3. That was logical, but wrong. The mouse was back the very next evening, which just happened to be the first of Percy Wetmore's two nights off before he slid over to the graveyard shift. Steamboat Willie showed up around 7 o'clock. I was there to see his reappearance, and so was Dean. Harry Terwilliger, too. Harry was on the desk. I was technically on days, but had stuck around to spend an extra hour with the chief, whose time was getting close by then. Bitterbuck was stoical on the outside in the tradition of his tribe, but I could see his fear of the end growing inside him like a poison flower. So we talked. You could talk to them in the daytime, but it wasn't so good, with the shouts and conversation, not to mention the occasional fist fight coming from the exercise yard, the chonk, chonk, chonk of the stamping machines in the plate shop, the occasional yell of a guard for someone to put down that pick or grab up that hoe or just to get your ass over here, Harvey. After 4, it got a little better, and after 6, it got better still. 6 to 8 was the optimum time. After that, you could see the long thoughts starting to steal over their minds again. In their eyes, you could see it, like afternoon shadows, and it was best to stop. They still heard what you were saying, but it no longer made sense to them. Past 8, they were getting ready for the watches of the night, and imagining how the cap would feel when it was clamped to the tops of their heads, and how the air would smell inside the black bag which had been rolled down over their sweaty faces. But I got the chief at a good time. He told me about his first wife, and how they had built a lodge together up in Montana. Those had been the happiest days of his life, he said. The water was so pure and so cold that it felt like your mouth was cut every time you drank. "Hey, Mr. Edgecombe," he said, "you think if a man he sincerely repent of what he done wrong, he might get to go back to the time that was happiest for him and live there forever? Could that be what heaven is like?" "I've just about believed that very thing," I said. Which was a lie I didn't regret in the least. I had learned of matters eternal at my mother's pretty knee, and what I believed is what the good book says about murderers, that there is no eternal life in them. I think they go straight to hell, where they burn in torment until God finally gives Gabriel the nod to blow the judgment trump. When he does, they'll wink out, and probably glad to go they will be. But I never gave a hint of such beliefs to Bitterbuck or to any of them. I think in their hearts they knew it. "Where is your brother? His blood crieth to me from the ground," God said to Cain, and I doubt if the words were much of a surprise to that particular problem child. I bet he heard Abel's blood whining out of the earth at him with each step he took. The chief was smiling when I left, perhaps thinking about his lodge in Montana and his wife lying bare-breasted in the light of the fire. He would be walking in a warmer fire soon, I had no doubt. I went back up the corridor, and Dean told me about his set-to with Percy the previous night. I think he'd waited around just so he could, and I listened carefully. I always listened carefully when the subject was Percy, because I agreed with Dean 100%. I thought Percy was the sort of man who could cause a lot of trouble, as much for the rest of us as for himself. As Dean was finishing, old Toot Toot came by with his red snack wagon, which was covered with hand-lettered Bible quotes, "Repent, for the Lord shall judge his people," Deuteronomy 32, verse 36, "and surely the blood of your lives I will require," Genesis 9, verse 5, and similar cheery, uplifting sentiments, and sold us some sandwiches and pops. Dean was hunting for change in his pocket and saying that we wouldn't see Steamboat Willie anymore, that goddamn Percy Wetmore had scared him off for good, when old Toot Toot said,
What's that there, then?
We looked, and here came the mouse of the hour his own self, hopping up the middle of the green mile. He'd come a little way, then stop, look around with his bright little oil-drop eyes, then come on again. "Hey, mouse," the chief said. And the mouse stopped and looked at him, whiskers twitching. I tell you, it was exactly as if the damn thing knew it had been called. "You some kind of spirit guide?" Bitterbuck tossed the mouse a little morsel of cheese from his supper. It landed right in front of the mouse, but Steamboat Willie hardly even glanced at it, just came on its way again up the green mile looking in empty cells.
"Boss Edgecombe," the president called. "You think that little bastard knows Wetmore isn't here? I do, by God."
I felt about the same, but I wasn't going to say so out loud. Harry came out into the hall, hitching up his pants the way he always did after he'd spent a refreshing few minutes in the can, and stood there staring with his eyes wide. Toot Toot was also staring, a sunken grin doing unpleasant things to the soft and toothless lower half of his face. The mouse stopped in what was becoming its usual spot, curled its tail around its paws, and looked at us. Again I was reminded of pictures I had seen of judges passing sentence on hapless prisoners. Yet had there ever been a prisoner as small and unafraid as this one? Not that it really was a prisoner, of course. It could come and go pretty much as it pleased. Yet the idea would not leave my mind, and it again occurred to me that most of us would feel that small when approaching God's judgment seat after our lives were over, but very few of us would be able to look so unafraid.
"Well, I swear," old Toot Toot said. "There he sits, big as Billy be frigged."
"You ain't seen nothing yet, Toot," Harry said. "Watch this."
He reached into his breast pocket and came out with a slice of cinnamon apple wrapped in waxed paper. He broke off the end and tossed it on the floor. It was dry and hard, and I thought it would bounce right past the mouse, but it reached out one paw, as carelessly as a man swatting at a fly to pass the time, and batted it flat. We all laughed in admiration and surprise, an outburst of sound that should have sent the mouse skittering, but it barely twitched. It picked up the piece of dried apple in its paws, gave it a couple of licks, then dropped it and looked up at us as if to say, "Not bad, what else do you have?" Toot Toot opened his cart, took out a sandwich, unwrapped it, and tore off a scrap of bologna.
"Don't bother," Dean said.
"What do you mean?" Toot Toot asked. "Ain't a mouse alive that paws up bologna if he could get it. You're a crazy guy."
But I knew Dean was right, and I could see by Harry's face that he knew it too. There were floaters, and there were regulars. Somehow that mouse seemed to know the difference. Nuts, but true. Old Toot Toot tossed the scrap of bologna down, and sure enough the mouse wouldn't have a thing to do with it. Sniffed it once, and then backed off a pace.
"I'll be a goddamn son of a bitch,"
old Toot Toot said, sounding offended. I held out my hand. "Give it to me."
"What, same sandwich?"
"Same one. I'll pay for it." Toot Toot handed it over. I lifted the top slice of bread, tore off another sliver of meat, and dropped it over the front of the duty desk. The mouse came forward at once, picked it up in its paws, and began to eat. The bologna was gone before you could say Jack Robinson.
"I'll be goddamned," Toot Toot cried. "Bloody hell, give me that."
He snatched back the sandwich, tore off a much larger piece of meat, not a scrap this time, but a flap, and dropped it so close to the mouse that Steamboat Willie almost ended up wearing it for a hat. It drew back again, sniffed. Surely no mouse ever hit such a jackpot during the Depression, not in our state at least, and then looked up at us.
"Go on, eat it," Toot Toot said, sounding more offended than ever. "What's wrong with you?"
Dean took the sandwich and dropped a piece of meat. By then it was like some strange communion service. The mouse picked it up at once and bolted it down. Then it turned and went back down the corridor to the restraint room, pausing along the way to peer into a couple of empty cells and to take a brief investigatory tour of a third. Once again, the idea that it was looking for someone occurred to me,
and this time I dismissed the thought more slowly.
"I'm not going to talk about this,"
Harry said. He sounded as if he was half-joking, half-not.
"First of all, nobody'd care. Second, they wouldn't believe me if they did."
"He only ate from you fellas," Toot-Toot said. He shook his head in disbelief, then bent laboriously over, picked up what the mouse had disdained, and popped it into his own toothless maw, where he began the job of gumming it into submission. "Now why he do that?"
"I've got a better one," Harry said. "How'd he know Percy was off?"
"He didn't," I said. "It was just coincidence, that mouse showing up tonight." Except that got harder and harder to believe as the days went by and the mouse showed up only when Percy was off, on another shift, or in another part of the prison. We, Harry, Dean, Brutal, and me, decided that it must know Percy's voice, or his smell. We carefully avoided too much discussion about the mouse itself, himself. That, we seemed to have decided without saying a word, might go a long way towards spoiling something that was special and beautiful by virtue of its strangeness and its delicacy. Willie had chosen us, after all, in some way I do not understand, even now. Maybe Harry came closest when he said it would do no good to tell other people, not just because they wouldn't believe, but because they wouldn't care. Chapter 4 Then it was time for the execution of Arlen Bitterbuck, in reality no chief but first elder of his tribe on the Ouachita Reservation, and a member of the Cherokee Council as well. He had killed a man while drunk, while both of them were drunk, in fact. The chief had crushed the man's head with a cement block. At issue had been a pair of boots. So, on July 17th of that rainy summer, my council of elders intended for his life to end. Visiting hours for most Cold Mountain prisoners were as rigid as steel beams, but that didn't hold for our boys on E Block. So on the 16th, Bitterbuck was allowed over to the long room adjacent to the cafeteria, the arcade. It was divided straight down the middle by mesh interwoven with strands of barbed wire. Here the chief would visit with his second wife and those of his children who would still treat with him. It was time for the goodbyes. He was taken over there by Bill Dodge and two other floaters. The rest of us had work to do. 1 hour to cram in at least two rehearsals, three if we could manage it. Percy didn't make much protest over being put in the switch room with Jack Van Hay for the Bitterbuck electrocution. He was too green to know if he was being given a good spot or a bad one. What he did know was that he had a rectangular mesh window to look through, and although he probably didn't care to be looking at the back of the chair instead of the front, he would still be close enough to see the sparks flying. Right outside that window was a black wall telephone with no crank or dial on it. That phone could only ring in, and only from one place, the governor's office. I've seen lots of jailhouse movies over the years where the official phone rings just as they're getting ready to pull the switch on some poor innocent sap, but ours never rang during all my years on E Block. Never once. In the movies, salvation is cheap. So is innocence. You pay a quarter, and a quarter's worth is just what you get. Real life costs more, and most of the answers are different. We had a tailor's dummy down in the tunnel for the run to the meat wagon, and we had old Toot-Toot for the rest. Over the years, Toot had somehow become the traditional stand-in for the condemned, as time-honored in his way as the turkey you sit down to on Thanksgiving, whether you like turkey or not. Most of the other screws liked him, were amused by his funny accent, also French but Canadian rather than Cajun, and softened into its own thing by his years of incarceration in the South. Even Brutal got a kick out of old Toot. Not me, though. I thought he was, in his way, an older and dimmer version of Percy Wetmore, a man too squeamish to kill and cook his own meat, but who did, all the same, just love the smell of a barbecue. We were all there for the rehearsal, just as we would all be there for the main event. Brutus Howell had been put out, as we said, which meant that he would place the cap, monitor the governor's phone line, summon the doctor from his place by the wall if he were needed, and give the actual order to roll on two when the time came. If it went well, there would be no credit for anyone. If it didn't go well, Brutal would be blamed by the witnesses, and I would be blamed by the warden. Neither of us complained about this. It wouldn't have done any good. The world turns, that's all. You can hold on and turn with it, or stand up to protest and be spun right off. Dean, Harry Terwilliger, and I walked down to the chief's cell for the first rehearsal, not 3 minutes after Bill and his troops had escorted Bitterbuck off the block and over to the arcade. The cell door was open, and old Toot Toot sat on the chief's bunk, his wispy white hair flying.
"There cum stains all over the sheet," Toot Toot remarked. "He must be trying to get rid of it before you fellas boil it off."
And he cackled. "Shut up, Toot," Dean said. "Let's play this serious."
"Okay,"
Toot Toot said, immediately composing his face into an expression of thunderous gravity. But his eyes twinkled. Old Toot never looked so alive as when he was playing dead. I stepped forward. "Arlen Bitterbuck, as an officer of the court and of the state of blah blah, I have a warrant for blah blah, such execution to be carried out at 1201 on blah blah. Will you step forward?" Toot got off the bunk.
"I'm stepping forward, I'm stepping forward, I'm stepping forward," he said.
"Turn around," Dean said, and when Toot Toot turned, Dean examined the dandruffy top of his head. The crown of the chief's head would be shaved tomorrow night, and Dean's check then would be to make sure he didn't need a touch-up. Stubble could impede conduction, make things harder. Everything we were doing today was about making things easier. "All right, Arlen, let's go," I said to Toot Toot, and away we went.
"I'm walking down the corridor, I'm walking down the corridor, I'm walking down the corridor," Toot said.
I flanked him on the left, Dean on the right. Harry was directly behind him. At the head of the corridor, we turned right, away from life as it was lived in the exercise yard, and toward death as it was died in the storage room. We went into my office, and Toot dropped to his knees without having to be asked. He knew the script all right, probably better than any of us. God knew he'd been there longer than any of us.
"I'm praying, I'm praying, I'm praying," Toot Toot said,
holding his gnarled hands up. They looked like that famous engraving. You probably know the one I mean.
"The Lord is my shepherd," so on and so forth.
"Who's Bitterbuck got?" Harry asked. "We're not going to have some Cherokee medicine man in here shaking his dick, are we?"
"Actually, still praying, still praying, still getting right with Jesus,"
Toot overrode me.
"Shut up, you old gink," Dean said.
"I'm praying."
"Then pray to yourself." "What's keeping you guys?" Brutal hollered in from the storage room. That had also been emptied for our use. We were in the killing zone again, all right. It was a thing you could almost smell.
"Hold your friggin' water," Harry yelled back. "Don't be so goddamn impatient."
"Praying," Toot said, grinning his unpleasant sunken grin. "Praying for patience. Just a little goddamn patience."
"Actually, Bitterbuck's a Christian, he says," I told them. "And he's perfectly happy with the Baptist guy who came for Tillman Clark. Schuster, his name is. I like him, too. He's fast, and he doesn't get him all worked up." "On your feet, Toot. You prayed enough for one day."
"Walking," Toot said. "Walking again, yes, sir. Walking on the Green Mile."
Short as he was, he still had to duck a little to get through the door on the far side of the office. The rest of us had to duck even more. This was a vulnerable time with a real prisoner, and when I looked across to the platform where old Sparky stood and saw Brutal with his gun drawn, I nodded with satisfaction. Just right. Toot Toot went down the steps and stopped. The folding wooden chairs, about 40 of them, were already in place.
Bitterbuck would cross to the platform on an angle that would keep him safely away from the seated spectators, and half a dozen guards would be added for insurance. Bill Dodge would be in charge of those. We had never had a witness menaced by a condemned prisoner, in spite of what was admittedly a raw setup, and that was how I meant to keep it.
"Ready, boys?" Toot asked when we were back in our original formation at the foot of the stairs leading down from my office.
I nodded, and we walked to the platform. What we looked like more than anything, I often thought, was a color guard that had forgotten its flag.
"What am I supposed to do?"
Percy called from behind the wire mesh between the storage room and the switch room.
"Watch and learn," I called back. "And keep your hands off your wiener," Harry muttered.
Toot Toot heard him, though, and cackled. We escorted him up onto the platform, and Toot turned around on his own, the old vet in action.
"Sittin' down," he said. "Sittin' down, sittin' down. Take in a seat in old Sparky's lap."
I dropped to my right knee before his right leg. Dean dropped to his left knee before his left leg. It was at this point we ourselves would be most vulnerable to physical attack, should the condemned man go berserk, which every now and then they did. We both turned the cocked knee slightly inward to protect the crotch area. We dropped our chins to protect our throats, and of course we moved to secure the ankles and neutralize the danger as fast as we could. The chief would be wearing slippers when he took his final promenade, but "it could have been worse" isn't much comfort to a man with a ruptured larynx. Or writhing on the floor with his balls swelling up to the size of mason jars, for that matter, while 40 or so spectators, many of them gentlemen of the press, sit in those Grange Hall chairs watching the whole thing. We clamped Toot Toot's ankles. The clamp on Dean's side was slightly bigger because it carried the juice. When Bitterbuck sat down tomorrow night, he would do so with a shaved left calf. Indians have very little body hair, as a rule, but we would take no chances. While we were clamping Toot Toot's ankles, Brutal secured his right wrist. Harry stepped smoothly forward and clamped the left. When they were done, Harry nodded to Brutal, and Brutal called back to Van Hay, "Roll on one!" I heard Percy asking Jack Van Hay what that meant. It was hard to believe how little he knew, how little he'd picked up during his time on E-Block, and Van Hay's murmur of explanation. Today, roll on one meant nothing, but when he heard Brutal say it tomorrow night, Van Hay would turn the knob that goosed the prison generator behind B-Block. The witnesses would hear the Jenny as a steady, low humming, and the lights all over the prison would brighten. In the other cell blocks, prisoners would observe those over-bright lights and think it had happened. The execution was over, when in fact it was just beginning. Brutal stepped around the chair so that Toot could see him.
"Mal and Bitterbuck, you have been condemned to die in the electric chair, sentence passed by a jury of your peers and imposed by a judge in good standing in this state. God save the people of this state. You have anything to say before sentence is carried out?"
"Yeah," Toot said, eyes gleaming, lips bunched in a toothless, happy grin. "I want a fried chicken dinner with gravy on the taters. I want to shit in your hat, and I got to have Mae West sit on my face because I'm one horny motherfucker."
Brutal tried to hold on to his stern expression, but it was impossible. He threw back his head and began laughing. Dean collapsed onto the edge of the platform like he'd been gut-shot, head down between his knees, howling like a coyote, with one hand clapped to his brow as if to keep his brains in there where they belonged. Harry was knocking his own head against the wall and going, "Huh, huh, huh," as if he had a glob of food stuck in his throat. Even Jack Van Hay, a man not known for his sense of humor, was laughing. I felt like it myself, of course I did, but controlled it somehow. Tomorrow night it was going to be for real, and a man would die there where Toot Toot was sitting.
"Shut up, Brutal," I said. "You too, Dean. Harry. And Toot, the next remark like that to come out of your mouth will be your last. I'll have Van Hay roll on two for real."
Toot gave me a grin, as if to say, "That was a good un, boss Edgecombe, a real good un." It faltered into a narrow, puzzled look when he saw I wasn't answering it.
"What's wrong with you?" he asked.
"It's not funny," I said.
That's what's wrong with me, and if you're not smart enough to get it, you better just keep your gob shut. Except it was funny in its way, and I suppose that was what had really made me mad. I looked around, saw Brutal staring at me, still grinning a little. Shit, I said. I'm getting too old for this job. No, Brutal said, you're in your prime, Paul. But I wasn't. Neither was he, and both of us knew it. Still, the important thing was that the laughing fit had passed. That was good, because the last thing I wanted was somebody remembering Toot's smart aleck remark tomorrow night and getting going again. You'd say such a thing would be impossible, a guard laughing his ass off as he escorted a condemned man past the witnesses to the electric chair, but when men are under stress, anything can happen. And a thing like that, people would have talked about it for 20 years. "Are you going to be quiet, Toot?" I asked. "Yes," he said, his averted face that of the world's oldest, poutiest child. I nodded to Brutal that he should get on with the rehearsal. He took the mask from the brass hook on the back of the chair and rolled it down over Toot Toot's head, pulling it snug under his chin, which opened the hole at the top to its widest diameter. Then Brutal leaned over, picked the wet circle of sponge out of the bucket, pressed one finger against it, then licked the tip of the finger. That done, he put the sponge back in the bucket. Tomorrow he wouldn't. Tomorrow he would tuck it into the cap perched on the back of the chair. Not today, though. There was no need to get Toot's old head wet. The cap was steel, and with the straps dangling down on either side, it looked sort of like a doughboy's helmet. Brutal put it on old Toot Toot's head, snugging it down over the hole in the black head covering.
"Get in the cap! Get in the cap! Get in the cap!" Toot said, and now his voice sounded squeezed as well as muffled.
The straps held his jaw almost closed, and I suspected Brutal had snugged it down a little tighter than he strictly had to for purposes of rehearsal. He stepped back, faced the empty seats, and said, "All in Bitterbuck, electricity shall not be passed through your body until you are dead, in accordance with state law. May God have mercy on your soul." Brutal turned to the mesh-covered rectangle. "Roll on to." Old Toot, perhaps trying to recapture his earlier flair of comic genius, began to buck and flail in the chair, as old Sparky's actual customers almost never did.
"Now I'm frying!" he cried. "Frying! Frying! Yeah! I'm a Dun-Tom turkey!"
Harry and Dean, I saw, were not watching this at all. They had turned away from Sparky and were looking across the empty storage room at the door leading back into my office.
"Well, I'll be goddamned," Harry said. "One of the witnesses came a day early."
Sitting in the doorway, with its tail curled neatly around its paws, watching with its beady black oil-spot eyes, was the mouse. Chapter 5. The execution went well. If there was ever such a thing as a good one, a proposition I strongly doubt, then the execution of Arlen Bitterbuck, Council Elder of the Ouachita Cherokee, was it. He got his braids wrong, his hands were shaking too badly to make a good job of it, and his eldest daughter, a woman of 30-odd, was allowed to plait them nice and even. She wanted to weave feathers in at the tips, the pin feathers of a hawk, his bird, but I couldn't allow that. They might catch fire and burn. I didn't tell her that, of course, just said it was against regulations. She made no protest, only bowed her head and put her hands to her temples to show her disappointment and her disapproval. She conducted herself with great dignity, that woman, and by doing so practically guaranteed that her father would do the same. The chief left his cell with no protest or holding back when the time came. Sometimes we had to pry their fingers off the bars. I broke one or two in my time and have never forgotten the muffled, snapping sound. But the chief wasn't one of those, thank God. He walked strong up the green mile to my office, and there he dropped to his knees to pray with Brother Schuster, who had driven down from the Heavenly Light Baptist Church in his flivver. Schuster gave the chief a few psalms, and the chief started to cry when Schuster got to the one about lying down beside the still waters.
It wasn't bad, though, no hysteria, nothing like that. I had an idea he was thinking about still water so pure and so cold it felt like it was cutting your mouth every time you drank some. Actually, I like to see them cry a little. It's when they don't that I get worried. A lot of men can't get up from their knees again without